In Jennifer Haley's play of the same name, The Nether is the internet of tomorrow, and it's evolved into an entire virtual reality, a kind of second life that lets you live through your avatar. In its midst is The Hideaway, a deeply encrypted, entirely anonymous space where consenting adults can play out their darkest fantasies, in particular as the play focuses in on simulated acts of paedophilia. With me today to discuss the play, which opened at the Royal Court in 2014 before transferring across to the West End, is the director, Jeremy Herring. Jeremy, welcome to Theatre Voice.
Thank you, Matt.
So tell me what appealed about this play when it landed on your desk at Headlong.
Well, I'd been looking for a play that dealt with the world that, you know, is sort of gathering around us, this world of technology that is growing at such a fast rate. And I'd been looking at internet plays for many years and always thought it was a fantastic subject and one that we needed to address as a culture. And I'd never found one. You know, a few plays over the years attempted to put the internet on stage, and it never quite worked for me. I never believed it. It never felt like the right medium for it. And so when I read Jennifer's play, I just thought it was an inspired way of actually addressing some of the issues by amplifying the jeopardy of the issues. And in terms of staging, I could really see it happening, because she chooses to represent the kind of future of that technology with a kind of neo-Victorian, sort of icky neo-Victorian thing. So I thought that would play to theatre's intense strengths, and so that it wouldn't be avatars doing sort of slightly awkward sort of movement style mime acting in, you know, in order to show that they're sort of not really human. So I thought it was a kind of appetizing theatrical prospect, and I thought that the kind of provocation of the play, how she forces the issues with taking sort of paedophilia and that sort of nefarious world as its mechanism, just meant that everybody's going to have a strong reaction and engage with what's going on in the play. So, if you know, that felt like a really good opportunity.
It's an extraordinary thing to hone in on as well. It feels like it's the one thing. She couldn't have picked a more sort of potent area to start exploring in some ways.
And I think that's, you know, that's the point, in that you can't shrug it off. You can't abstract that. Everybody's got a very strong visceral feeling, inbuilt, you know, probably deep in our genes, is that we don't want children to be harmed, and we know that, and we're really clear about it. So it forces the idea of how abstract and how real it is. It forces it back onto an audience, so that an audience is it, you know, the play itself insists that the audience address it properly.
I remember when I spoke to Jennifer when it was opening at the Royal Court, and she said, you know, there's stuff out there at the moment that is not a million miles away. She spoke about some of the precedents, and it's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, as soon as you engage with the play and you think, well, this is a kind of abstraction in order to set the argument up, to set it rolling, and as soon as you start working on it, you start researching it, you realise that actually it's relatively tame. Mm. There's a particular thing that I read about, which is a Japanese video game from, I think it was issued in about 2006, called Roleplay, which was within the kind of usership of the game, you could abduct a mother and her two daughters on the subway in Japan and have sex with them and then kill them. And that was all part of the game.
It's utterly
jaw-dropping, yeah, about how that's out there and how people would respond to it. And, you know, of course, it brings up the whole idea of what's acceptable. If it's virtual, isn't that acceptable? If no one's being harmed, is that okay? Which is such an emotive way of, you know, making sure that people engage with that subject. So, it felt like a kind of an exciting thing to do, because it's so dangerous and so important.
But I suppose also within the play, she's calibrated the morality of that really carefully, so that you can't, it's not as simple as just saying this is outrageous. It's so delicately put that that sense that the way that Sims, the guy who set up the Hideaway, says that this is part of his character, and actually it is a safe space for him to be himself.
Yeah.
And you kind of, a libertarian perspective is to go, well, that's okay.
Yeah. I mean, it all comes down to the sort of bigger question of, is anyone being harmed? If it's virtual, is it, you know, and it's not actually harming anyone, is that acceptable? And that's kind of, you know, very quickly becomes deeply philosophical about how we define reality and who we are and how we relate. Because one of the big arguments in the play is the idea that it's an excuse, it's the place, the realm that he's created is a place where broken people can connect with each other. Someone uses the term pure spirit, which is a sort of fantasy about relating on a deeper level beyond the corporeal, which conveniently avoids any harm that might take place.
It struck me as well that there's a sort of a note running through the play whereby they all insist on its reality at some level. All of the characters, they wouldn't be there unless there was something real about that space or the act of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating, and it's brilliant doing it as a piece of theatre, which of course trades on exactly that same conundrum, which is illusion versus reality, and where those things blur, you know, particularly in a kind of postmodern perspective where a lot of what is happening within the theatrical space is in essence really happening, because that's actually happening. Remember, we met before and we talked about working with children, and I probably used the phrase about the fact of a child in a theatrical space, so that the child is pretending to be another character, but actually that physical being is there in that space. So there's kind of wonderful resonances and a sort of blurring of these areas between both those things. And so when you're having a debate about illusion and reality, to do it theatrically is really fascinating, particularly when people get confused about what's really happening in terms of the theatrical transaction, and they worry about what's happening to the children. And part of course of the stock in trade is to give the impression that these children, or the children being representations of avatars as it were, but to play with the idea and to enjoy the idea that real harm is going to take.
Well, there's that extraordinary moment, isn't there, where you've sort of, the moment you've clocked the rules of the play, the world it's setting up, and there's a child, an actual child on stage, and you don't know what you're going to be asked or forced to watch when you're sitting through it. That's an extraordinary thing for an audience.
Yeah, but that's what I think, you know, in lots of ways, that's why we go to the theatre, isn't it? It's to have our imaginations harnessed, and our imagination, you know, it's completely terrifying what we're capable of imagining. It's much worse than anything that's actually going to happen. But it's those suggestions, you know, I suppose it's like all the best horror, it's in the pause before the thing happens that it really starts to work.
Because actually it's quite carefully written, isn't it, so that the child is always sort of at one remove from any...
Yeah, I mean, I've said this before, but the child isn't asked to do anything that they wouldn't be asked to do in any other drama. You know, the children are completely safe, and they have a really positive and fun time doing the show, which is very weird for people who've seen it, because they're so deeply traumatised by the whole thing. But actually the thing that traumatises them is the juxtaposition of those ideas,
right.
And I think that's you know, that's theatre in essence, is suggestion, and really it's not sort of presenting a kind of fixed thing to an audience. It's recruiting an audience to create that story, to, you know, for us all to create that story together somehow, and that's why it's such a powerful medium.
It's also a detective story, which is a really interesting sort of mode of storytelling, but it makes it incredibly gripping as a result.
Yeah.
What I know, Rupert Gould said that's sort of the detective story is kind of one of the keys to the age. What do you think it does in terms of as a piece of drama to play it back?
We know the rules.
Okay.
I think we know the rules, and therefore you can play with the rules and you can subvert the rules, or you can thematically you can go into all sorts of territory with a large audience that you probably wouldn't do if you were foregrounding theme over genre, if you know what I mean. So this, what's incredibly pleasing for me as Headlong, you know, artist director of Headlong, is to produce a play that deals with the kind of most intense and unanswerable questions of our age in a kind of gripping populist thriller, where whether an audience are keen to engage with those themes or not, they really want to know who done it. And so they're sat there, and you know, there's a very strong narrative line that just shuts them up and dumps them out on St. Martin's Lane, which is really, it's really gratifying, particularly because it came from a gesture of slight sort of dismissive gesture when Jen was persuaded by a writing teacher to write what she hated. So she wrote a police procedural because she thought they were sort of ridiculous and pants. So she wrote a police procedural, but set it in the future, in a time of environmental collapse where big business is ruling the roost in a series of different virtual worlds, and sort of found that bizarrely to be a kind of perfect platform for a Beshavian inquiry into one of the biggest questions of our age.
There's something, I mean, you mentioned the sort of the difference between this post-environmental collapse and this beautiful world of the Nether, the Victoriana, the ickiness of it, but also the trees. This beautiful sort of shimmering trees that are running through the Nether.
Yeah.
Tell me about the specifics of how that hideaway is designed.
Well, the design was a great opportunity. I've always wanted to work with Es Devlin, and it was a really good one in that she responded immediately to the play, and we had a great time working out how to do it. And one of the briefs that I gave her was, in order to support the argument and not to, because you know that's the job. My feelings about the subject are kind of irrelevant. My job is to keep those arguments, both sides of the arguments, buoyant until the end. And one of the ways in which we thought we could do that would be to make the hideaway, which is this paedophiliac realm, stuff of nightmares, is to make that a really pleasant place for an audience to be. So that already you're scrambling expectations, and you're making that kind of, you're implicating them in some way. Because just purely theatrically, it's just gorgeous to be in that space. And being in the other space, the space where the so-called real world is less pleasant. There's nothing to look at. There's a whole lot of scrambled, sort of digitized imagery of the stuff of what we imagine sort of the future of police interrogation to be, lie detectors and, you know, eyeball monitoring, stuff that isn't pleasing to look at. And then it opens up into this really cavernous space that... that Sonia Friedman in the transfer from the court to the West End has just supported, in this beautiful, mirrored, endless infinity space with these trees. So, you know, it's a good opportunity to not be literal about the Victorian hideaway, and not to be too hamstrung by having to represent real rooms and real space, because an audience is witty enough to understand that gesture. But actually the sensation of being in there felt like a good opportunity to play with that. And so that, you know, that was a series of really lovely choices that Luke Halls, who did the video work, really supported by showing the transitions from one space to another.
I think it's the perfectionism of it is my favourite thing about the play, the sense that actually the hideaway and the Nether maybe can be a place that we escape this sort of imperfect, harsh, cold world, and we can kind of be what we want to be in that space.
Yeah.
I think that it's a really delicate side to the play. Yeah. It's rather beautiful.
Yeah, and should you police that? Should that be policed? Is it real? Is any of it happening? I mean, the play rests on, as you know, the play rests on the possibility of a real victim behind it all. And of course, the people being those avatars aren't necessarily unharmed. So that's where the two worlds clash. But it's a really interesting idea. I mean, you know, who doesn't want... Sims says early on in that he wants to create a place of no consequence, and a place where we are changeless. And, you know, who doesn't want to engage with that kind of magic elixir and the possibility of that? You know, that's a staple of fiction and of art over the years, and there's something really compelling about that fantasy.
It was interesting reading it again today and realising how sort of broken a man Doyle is.
Yeah.
In that he's lost his job or become redundant within it. He feels like he's old and past it. And it sort of, for the first time, realised that it's not necessarily about sex for him. And it's not a fantasy in terms of the cosplay of being this avatar, yeah. the young girl, is something very different, very sort of emotional and yeah. touching, actually. At some
yeah, he, you're right. He describes himself as broken, or he includes himself in people that are broken, and he's weirdly found himself in that his life is so dysfunctional. The future of education has all gone into the nether. The futuristic version of the internet. People don't need teachers. They don't need science teachers anymore. They just need monitors patrolling their internet use, as it were. And this guy, an inspiring teacher, is useless, has no function, and has found himself feeling complete whilst pretending to be a child.
Mm. I was going to ask about Doyle being played by two actors, once at the Royal Court, yeah, yeah. in the West End.
Yeah.
How does that process change the play? What do the two performances bring that are different tones to it?
Well, they're both called David, which is a fantastic. You know, it's good to have a system in terms of your casting. So you can change your surname, but your first name's got to stay the same. Now, David Beams, he played at the Court, did a fantastic job. And David Calder joined us in the West End. Well, these things are really they're you know, a cast and a company is a fragile sort of ecosystem, in that you add any new ingredient, it's going to change the whole thing. And so the play is inevitably different. I mean, it's different on a night-to-night basis because, you know, the ecosystem that is the theatrical space is different every night because different group of people turn up to see it. So that's why it shifts and it changes. And I'm all for those changes, and I'm all for the actors being in the moment and being free to communicate the play as it feels on any given evening. And of course, when you change an actor, you get a different thing. So there's a different physicality, there's a different rhythm, there's a different understanding, there's bound to be different backstory. I don't know how I would classify the differences. I mean, I look forward to seeing David Beams again. He's going to join us for the last couple of weeks of the run in the West End, because David Calder is going to go and be Winston Churchill in the audience, Peter Morgan's play, and so, you know, that'd be a real challenge for him to go from Doyle to Churchill. I really hope he doesn't get them mixed up, or maybe be quite entertaining if he does. I don't know. So it's great, and it's, I mean, I know that's a really woolly answer, because it's difficult to qualify what it is. I suppose the other thing is that you have another go at it as a production. You know, you move it from the Royal Court to the West End. We've had another chance to look at it, another chance to try and solve some of the problems. So these things are dynamic and they're ongoing, and they're all kind of process.
What's it mean for the play to be in the West End? This very difficult and topical and urgent play,
yeah.
to be smack bang in the middle of theatre land.
It's great. I mean, it's really heartening. It's amazing because Sonia Friedman is just fantastic, and she is prepared to put herself on the line to commit to a show because she believes in it, because she thinks it's important and she thinks it's well done, and she's prepared to support it. And I can't say enough that's positive about Sonia, because she's really fantastic. And to sort of describe someone like Sonia as a commercial producer suggests that she's interested in money. It's quite the reverse. You know, she's interested in the art, and she's interested in getting that work out there. And the fact that we've got this provocative, mind-blowing, thrilling, really entertaining, don't want to undersell it, but it's a serious bit of work, on St. Martin's Lane, is a testament to her bravery and to the quality of the writing. So it's just given us all a chance to do what we do. And it's kind of wonderful. It's wonderful that, I mean, you know, with Headlong, we've got a really good recent track record. Chimerica and 1984 going in. It's work that's populist, but it's intellectually really robust and really serious work. And I think that's really fantastic, because I think even just in terms of the demographics, the West End is constantly having to reinvent itself. You know, it's constantly trying to find work that is appealing to people, and people don't want work that isn't about anything. You know, theatre is great for ideas, and that's really heartening.
Perfect. Jeremy, thank you very
much. Okay, cool.